Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of Endocrinology Network, and in this episode of the Endocrine Outlook, you'll be hearing from Dr. Jeffrey Curtis of the University of Alabama at Birmingham. A rheumatologist and leading expert in osteoporosis research, Curtis and I have a lengthy discussion around osteoporosis, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on treatment of the disease, and one of the most under-recognized issues in rheumatology, the under-treatment and under-diagnosis of osteoporosis in men. For our listeners, we start the conversation off with a discussion around a study Dr. Curtis led presented at ACR Convergence detailing the underdiagnosis and undertreatment of osteoporosis in men. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Curtis.
I had covered the one abstract that you presented at ACR related to diagnosis and treatment of men with osteoporosis. And now I wanted to pick your brain a little bit more on that study because I think osteoporosis in men is a topic that doesn't get talked about a lot. I know just from someone who covers the area, I don't get to write about it that much because there's not too many studies that are particularly focused on men. Did the results of this study surprise you? And other than being cognizant of it, what can clinicians do to improve the diagnosis and treatment of men with osteoporosis?
Well, certainly being cognizant of it helps. And I think, as you've already alluded to, there still is this sort of sexism attached to it that, you know, osteoporosis is only a disease of older white women. And, you know, while older white women certainly are at highest risk, as you well know, you know, men get osteoporosis too. About 20% of all fractures occur in men. So being cognizant of it is helpful, but screening systematically for it is better. So, you know, there are recommendations, say from the ISCD, that would suggest that all men over the age of 70 have a screening bone density test. So that would be something relatively straightforward to go look for low bone mass, low bone density. That is something that, while not technically part of the quality measures, and, you know, that was, I think that's an important omission that advocacy could ideally work towards. All of our osteoporosis quality measures are pretty much exclusive to women, and I think that is inappropriate. You know, a man who's broken his hip, for example, needs treatment just as much as a woman who's just broken her hip, and that's irrespective of race or ethnicity. I mean, in some sense, fracture is a great equalizer, and so that was obviously the focus of our study. But what people come into with their understanding of who's at highest risk mostly gets taken off the table once you've had a major fragility fracture, you know, hip, pelvis, humerus, femur, et cetera. So I think that the recognition of sort of post-fracture and to say, you know, yes, men are at lower risk on average, but not this man, because he's just broken a bone. You know, he has the very thing that I'm trying to be preventing. And yet, as you probably saw from the abstract, even those men generally weren't screened, weren't diagnosed, weren't treated ahead of time. And for the most part, they're not screened, treated, or diagnosed even following a major fracture.
Now, where obviously there's a lot of different issues going on when we look at rheumatic disease and sort of undertreated population groups, where does osteoporosis in men stand in terms of sort of immediate threat to a person's health? Because obviously, sometimes if someone's had one of these major fragility fractures, they're already on the course towards having bad overall health. What else can be done, and how large of an issue is osteoporosis in men compared to some of these other issues in rheumatologic care?
Yeah, I mean, it's insidious because, of course, osteoporosis is asymptomatic. And much like hyperlipidemia, nobody comes in and says, wow, I feel terrible. My cholesterol must be high. Nobody comes in and says, gosh, I feel terrible. My bones must be thin. Why don't we do something to prevent a fracture? So I think it doesn't get no respect, in the words of Rodney Dangerfield, because no one has symptoms until they break a bone. So I think that's part of it. And then I think you also described this, the concept of essentially multimorbidity. You have so many other things going on, frailty, a bunch of other medical problems, your other comorbidities, essentially crowds out osteoporosis. And in fact, in times past, we had published a paper really looking at those comorbidities to say, even in people who have bad COPD or heart failure, diabetes, you know, if you've just broken a bone, you know, what's the likelihood that you're going to break another before death? And, you know, does that exceed a threshold to treat? And the answer was yes. So, you know, even though people have comorbidities, most of the comorbidities that might seemingly crowd out osteoporosis management actually are risk factors for fracture. So, for example, stroke, if you have hemiplegia or Parkinson's disease, so neurologic conditions, you know, predispose to falls, that predisposes to fracture. You know, chronic kidney disease, many of the things that would put people at higher risk for frailty and overall bad health, as you've described it, are also risk factors for fracture. So, I don't think that any of those potential seemingly mitigating concerns should offset. In fact, it should heighten people's concern that, hey, somebody who's just broken a bone, you know, that's the highest risk group and let's prevent the next one. It is actually quite tragic that somebody has a major fracture and then, you know, within the next year or two has another spine fracture or breaks the hip on the other side or, you know, when nothing was done about it. And yet a lot of those fractures could have been mitigated and not occurred if people had been put on effective treatment in a timely way.
All right. And that sort of transitions nicely to the next abstract I wanted to talk about, which was this ACR rise analysis of osteoporosis treatments in America. And we saw, surprisingly, outside of denosumab, we saw sort of a dip in osteoporosis treatments among rheumatologists in this registry. Now, why do you think that dip is? And is that concerning to you, given sort of the topic we were just discussing regarding the underdiagnosis and undertreatment in men?
It is concerning. And obviously, the abstract doesn't answer your direct question of why is this occurring and what is the cause. But just to try to make inference, as you're probably well aware, the safety concerns, particularly of the bisphosphonate class of medicines, I think have dominated people's attention and certainly the media for a very long time. So osteonecrosis of the jaw and atypical femoral fractures, sort of these odd hip fractures, particularly for people who have been on therapy for quite a long time mostly, you know, people get very alarmed about that. They say, wait, how is it that this medicine I'm taking to prevent hip fractures, which, you know, 40% hip fracture risk reduction, it's pretty substantial. How can it increase the risk for hip fracture for this odd but and rare but real subtype that seems to be associated with long-term bisphosphonate therapy? So I think that safety concerns probably have been overweighted in the public's attention and even clinicians' minds to some extent. The idea of a drug holiday has gained ascendancy, and I think that on average that many people probably are appropriate candidates for a bisphosphonate drug holiday. Unfortunately, what I've just termed as a bisphosphonate drug holiday, some people are extending that to all medications, like, you know, I need to take a holiday from my bone medicine, not realizing that it is kind of a unique property of a bisphosphonate, you know, alendronate, zoledronate, et cetera, that it hangs around in bone and has this persistent benefit over a number of years after you stop. That's not true of other bone medicines. I mean, like most bone medicines and other things in medicine, treatments work when you take them, they quit working when you quit taking them. It's only this unique property of the bisphosphonate family of drugs that's not totally true, that there is this kind of persistent but waning, declining benefit over years. And so I think that the idea of a bisphosphonate drug holiday has sort of infiltrated people's minds to think that it applies to many other medicines or circumstances related to osteoporosis management, that it probably really doesn't.
Now, how do you, outside of maybe addressing it in guidelines, how do you sort of seek to quell the exaggeration in your eyes of these, the dangers of bisphosphonates?
Yeah, I mean, I think life is about risks and benefits, and obviously there's risks and benefits to getting up and getting in your car every day, but that's where I think that describing absolute fracture risk is helpful. And, you know, the FRAX tool that lets you calculate somebody's estimated fracture risk, I think is quite helpful, particularly for patients who, you know, in the old days when all we had was a T-score from a DEXA scanner and you struggled to know, you know, it's a T-score of -2.5, but this woman's only 50-something, and, you know, does that mean the same thing? And if she was 75, no, of course not. But I think that, you know, as you describe the risk and if you quantify them, you know, the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw being less than, you know, 1 out of 100 people and, you know, maybe more on the order of 1 out of 1,000, compared to your risk for a major fracture, which might be 20% or higher, you know, in a 10-year time frame. So I think that just describing sort of here's the likelihood of benefit in a quantitative or at least an understandable way to patients, and health literacy and numeracy shouldn't be assumed. You know, I tend to like to use pictures or icon arrays, or there's some ways you can visualize that to explain risks and benefits to patients, and then talk about medicines and their risks and benefits as well. But I think that people sort of discount the idea that not treating a disease or under treating it actually has some risks attached to it too. People only think about the risks of the medicine. They don't really juxtapose that with the risks of doing nothing or not treating this. The other thing is that there is some external reinforcement about the safety concerns, from particularly from dentists and oral surgeons. You know, people are coming in, they're very alarmed. My dentist is very concerned that you have me on whatever it is we're talking about. And he wants me to stop, and or at least to talk to you about stopping. And, you know, for some people that could be appropriate, or to pause if there's something imminent that's happening or going on. But I will remind people that I certainly respect your dentist or your oral surgeon's concern. On the other hand, if you were to fall and break your hip, you will not go see your dentist, I promise. So your dentist will never see the hip fracture that you or somebody else might have, and sort of isn't cognizant, because that's not what he or she's thinking about the hip fractures that somebody wouldn't have if they're on treatment. And sure, problems in the mouth are bad when they occur, but they are quite uncommon. But the dentist in the oral health community probably doesn't have the same perspective on people having major fractures. You know, the excess mortality, 1 in 5 people will be dead after a hip fracture within a year. But the thing that gets people even more than that is the loss of independence. The fact that about half of people never get back to their prior level of function. You know, having somebody help you walk, go to the bathroom, prepare meals for months as you're recovering from your major hip or pelvis fracture surgery, like, that's a big deal. And I've even had people who say, you know, when it's my time, it's my time. But while I understand and respect those sorts of decisions, nobody, I don't think, wants a loss of independence. You know, they don't want to be a burden to friends or family. You know, many people at the older ages of life are caregivers, say for their spouse or other people in their life. You know, they can't afford to go in a rehab hospital or a nursing home for months and months as they're recovering post-fracture. So I'm not advocating using scare tactics, but I do advocate that people make an informed decision. And I think sometimes patients don't think about the other side of the coin. You know, if we don't treat this and you had a fracture, what does that mean for your husband who, you know, just stopped driving due to dementia, or, you know, other things that are going to have some cascading implications in people's lives, where other people are going to, you know, have to help step in and provide care in the child generation of those older adults. But there may not be those people. And so I think people need to think through the idea that it's not that you're sick and old and frail, because some people just reject that notion out of hand, you know. And if you show me a picture of an older woman who looks like, frankly, she's kind of on death's door, that may not resonate with somebody younger. But the notion that we want to keep you doing well, we want to keep you healthy, and part of doing well and wellness is keeping your bones strong. And much like, you know, we want to avoid cancer, and so cancer screening, smoking cessation is appropriate, let's put this in the preventive health bucket. That preventive health says, let's keep your bones intact, let's keep your function intact, your mobility good, and your skeleton strong. And this is what that probably looks like for you. I think that shifts the conversation a lot on the upside of fractures avoided to maintaining independence. But then even for maybe for some younger women, but that are high risk, this notion of wellness and helping you continue to do well over the lifespan.
All right, thank you for that. And now transitioning a bit to osteoporosis as a whole and not just really in men. One of the things that we've seen this year, obviously it's impacted every field of medicine, has been the COVID-19 pandemic. And I know you weren't associated with this. I believe it was a study that came out in October or late September, but you mentioned FRAX scoring, and it found that FRAX scoring had or FRAX use had dipped by, I believe it was 20% or more. I would have to check, but during sort of the global pandemic, have you seen a reduction in the patients that you would normally go and test for BMD or for fracture risk? And what is sort of your level of concern about patients that may have been missed during this time period that would have normally been identified.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think as everybody would be aware of, you know, clinicians, patients, and anyone who has any thoughts about health and healthcare delivery, I think a lot of things got skipped and missed as people were afraid. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they were ill. That just means that they were afraid. So in fact, we have another abstract. I can give you the number if you care, but that showed that, you know, if you have osteoporosis, you're a lot more likely to skip visits and to not have in-person visits because, and where I'd speculate, I think it's probably because osteoporosis may be considered more discretionary. You know, again, it's not symptomatic, and so it may feel less urgent for people to get in and get screening. So I think that happens as a whole. People are less likely to have office visits. They're less likely to have vaccinations. There's data for that. But as you said, they're less likely to get osteoporosis care. And I think we, in this large population health study of many, many thousands of rheumatology patients, you know, we compared them to rheumatoid arthritis as the referent, and you know, compared to RA, you're more likely to miss osteoporosis-related care. The other thing that might even be more important, because you might argue, you know, you can skip your screening bone density test for 6 months as long as somebody remembers, or your monitoring DEXA. The thing that gave me even more pause is people are missing treatments. And as you're probably aware, particularly for some therapies like denosumab, it's probably not a good idea to miss treatments. That drug needs to be given every 6 to 7 months. There is a short-term increase in fracture risk. It's not huge, but it is there if you miss it by more than about a month or so, and vertebral fracture risk goes up, and then things sort of stabilize and go back to baseline again. But it's bad to miss denosumab. So I think that, you know, clinicians being aware of this and doing creative things to be able to circumvent this this gap in care where, you know, missing your treatments, it should not just be an oh well. And particularly for osteoporosis, you know, they may get skipped entirely because, again, you're not symptomatic, and I suspect that's more common. But for drugs like denosumab or romosozumab, you know, those need to be given on an every 6 month or an every 1 month window, and you don't want to miss that because that medicine starts wearing off, and, you know, at a minimum, you are going to start undoing the gains you've made, and perhaps even a bit more of a safety concern is if you miss denosumab by a meaningful fraction, as many people did during COVID. The one thing that might just be kind of almost a human interest health services delivery kind of thing, our institution was very concerned about this exact thing. We created a drive-through injection clinic for osteoporosis. So the idea is that you call the patient up and say, hey, ma'am, it's time for your denosumab, your Prolia. She smiled sweetly and said, yeah, I'm not coming into your medical center. Forget that. You know, it's COVID. And I'm not darkening the door of any healthcare facility, including yours. No, thank you. So after realizing this is going to be a big problem and COVID's not going away imminently, we created this drive-through biologic injection clinic. So the idea is that if you'll just come near where you normally would come for your healthcare, you don't have to get out of the car. So like an old time, you know, drive-in, you know, Sonic A&W root beer where the guy or gal comes out on roller skates, takes your order for burger, shake and fries and brings them to your car, we're going to bring the nurse and the pharmacist to your car. They're going to be masked. You're going to roll your window down. You'll roll your sleeve up. You'll show some ID. We'll give you your denosumab, your Prolia right there. You don't even have to get out of the car and you can just keep on driving. So it's in kind of the roundabout in front of the health system in this designated area. So this is our injection drive-through clinic that you can get biologic drugs for osteoporosis that need to be given on this pretty regular schedule. People love this. And, you know, even when COVID somewhat lessened as the months went on, you know, and there was certainly will within the institution, because this is kind of a more labor-intensive way to deliver care. You know, people said, please let us continue to have this. We love this. This is important. COVID's not disappearing instantly. So we've been able to persist delivering that service. Not everyone's going to be able to do that, but there certainly are innovative solutions. And I think that's as clever as any of them to try to get people the care delivery that they need and not miss. And particularly, we focused on osteoporosis care, but there are a few other biologic drugs that we're able to give in the same way that are dosed every month or two-ish kind of time frame that were also effective in being delivered that way. But osteoporosis was really the driving force behind what we needed to set the service up for.
Yeah, that sounds like an awesome idea for rheumatic diseases, and especially because I think one of the most overlooked factors of this pandemic is sort of the mental health impact that it can have on people, and having in their mind to be, quote unquote, maybe forced to come into the clinic and be exposed to that might be a little bit much for some patients. But that is about it on my questions. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks so much for your interest. Osteoporosis often gets both undercovered from less well covered from a medical health perspective. So thanks for your efforts to shine a spotlight on a very important public health problem.
Thank you again to Dr. Curtis for taking part in that interview. For the latest in endocrinology news, be sure to head to endocrinologynetwork.com. That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. I'm Patrick Campbell. Thank you for listening.